Appreciate the special music. I think I'd rather take a beating than sing. And move that. When you move it for Matthew, it's up here. Everybody else is kind of down below. Okay. Got a new Bible here, so it's kind of hard for me to find things. Because it's got a long introduction in the front, and so it doesn't feel quite exactly right. Okay, well, today, in the time I have allotted to me, which is... Okay, good. But the subject I'd like to cover today, and the title is, Are You Offended? I guess another way of putting it is, Are You Offendable? I know there is such a word. But let's just talk real briefly here, and I'm not going to turn to these verses, but I just want to talk real briefly to you about this, some of these other verses, and you just think about it. We'll cover them in the next time I speak on this subject. This is part one, so then we'll do part two on another. Not on atonement. I scheduled to speak on atonement, but it'll be on another day. But okay, one thing you might want to ask yourself, what is offense? What does it mean to be offended? Jesus offended a lot of people. So does that mean being offensive is okay? Why is it okay for him, but we're cautioned against it? If you have, we're told if your eye offends you, pluck it out. What does that mean? We're also told we're not to offend God. But Jesus offended people. Jesus offended people. How do we offend God? I'm not going to discuss these things today. I just want to introduce the thought. James tells us Paul says we offend people in many ways. He says that he has done that. There's lots of other areas where it talks about offense. And we'll talk about offense today from one perspective. And in the next time I speak on this subject, it'll be in another. But today I'd like to speak, and it sort of follows upon what Mr. McDonald talked about, Matthew 24:10. I'm just going to start there, and then we'll go to some just a few verses, because I don't really have a lot of verses I want to cover, because I want to cover them in detail. Matthew 24:10. And then shall many be led to sin, and shall betray one another, and shall hate one another. So what does it mean in this translation says be led into sin? And the King James translation says many should be offended. Many should be offended. Now the word led into sin is also translated offense, or you're offended. And in that word in the Greek means to be enticed to sin. Like a trap on a stick. So I was watching on YouTube. I had a physical this week. So I asked the doctor. I says, you know, I've been to the YouTube Medical College and graduated summa cum laude. So any questions she has, I'm willing to help her. But so I went to YouTube, and they were showing you how you can make a trap. And in the Hebrew and in the Greek, it talks about a trap as like one stick with a string on it. You can imagine how that looks. And an animal walks into the string, triggers the trap, catches them, and it sort of pulls the person up, I mean the victim up. And so, sure enough, show these people living in third world countries, and they eat rabbits because they're hungry, and they eat rats and other things. But anyway, so what they did is made a simple one stick thing, and a couple little odds and ends that they stick together. And they put this noose around the hole. Pretty soon, and then a little bait. So pretty soon the rabbit comes up, sticks his head through it, and walks through it, triggers the trap, and that stick pops, goes up, and here's the rabbit, or whatever it may be. So that's the kind of thing we're talking about. Many are in the led to sin, or enticed, or trapped. So how is it that we're enticed, and how does that got to do with offense? So let's take some time now to go to Psalms 119. Psalms 119. Let's go ahead and turn there. Psalms 119 is where I want to spend most of our time today. And we'll begin in verse 165, then we'll go back and build around it. Great peace have those who love your law, and there is no stumbling block for them. Or it says there is, King James has a little different translation, but this is, there's no stumbling block, there's no offense. So great peace have those who love your law, and there is nothing that causes them to stumble. Or there's no stumbling block. Let me read to you from the Amplified Version. There are several different types of the Amplified Version. There's Amplified Version with notes, Amplified Version with Well, I think I will read the Amplified Version here in just a second. Anyway, I'll just do it off the top of my head. Great abundance of, and the word here is shalom, or peace. So here, great peace, and shalom means more than that. It means peace of mind, peace of spirit, or your mind, your body. So when somebody says to you, shalom, that means, hello, I wish you well. I wish you, I hope you have a good day. I hope you have a profitable day. I hope you're feeling well mentally, emotionally, and spiritually. I hope that you're feeling well. So great shalom, or peace, have those who, and here the word love is, when you translate it from the Hebrew, meaning who have great affection. And it can even be used in a, from a romantic point of view, someone who has great affection for someone else. So great shalom, or peace, have those, so they have great peace of mind and spirit, have those who have an affection for God's law. In the word there is Torah, which means the Ten Commandments. And there is nothing, and it says in the literal translation, there is nothing. There's nothing existent that can cause one to stumble. There's nothing there that can make, if you truly love God's law. Well, I don't know anybody who's there yet, but we're working on that. So I hope today, as we go through this sermon, I'm going to ask you a lot of questions, and I'm not going to answer a lot of them, because I want you to own the sermon, and I want you to go home and look. I want you to go home and dig around and see what you can find in the scripture as I ask you various questions. Let's go now to verse 159 of this chapter. Consider how I love your precepts, O Lord. This is, of course, David, the author. According to your loving kindness, give me life. As it says here in this translation. So precepts are sort of a collective use of the Ten Commandments. It's a discussion of the Ten Commandments, how they're applied. There's precepts. The precepts and how you use them. My glasses are broken and I'm having a harder time reading with them than without them. So I'm supposed to go downtown and clean the car, get gas in the car, mail something for Lisa, get my glasses fixed. So I did all the those things except get my glasses fixed. Because going home, I forgot something, but I don't know what it is, as I grope my way home. Anyway. How I love your precepts, the law of God, O Lord, according to your loving kindness, give me life. So he's asking for God's loving and his kindness. Your word is true from the beginning, and every one of your righteous ordinances endures forever. An ordinance, if you will, is a verdict or a sentence or something that's passed down. You can even loosely put it as a judgment that once a precept is made clear, if you violate that precept, then there's a judgment that is called for. And he says he loves those the judgments and the precepts because they're just. Princes have persecuted me without a cause, but my heart stands in awe of your word. I rejoice at your word as one who finds great treasure. Most of your translations will say spoil, but treasure is also probably a better word for that if you look it up in your concordances and so forth. I hate and despise lying, but I love your law. Seven times a day do I praise you because of your righteous judgments. Great or an abundance of peace, great and overabundance, if you will, of shalom, peace, have those who have this affectionate love for your law. And there's no stumbling, there's nothing that can cause that person to stumble, which means we're not there yet. But that is the goal. Lord, I have hoped for your salvation, and you have and have done your commandments. My soul, my mind, my whole being has kept your testimonies, and I love them exceedingly. I have kept your precepts and your testimonies. I've been a witness for you, in other words, for all my ways are before you. So this is a man who's going through some very difficult times in his life. So as we go through here, we see someone who understands that if you truly love God's law, you're not offended. Now, question, and I'm not going to answer it, but I want you to think about it. God says, and I'm not going to go there today because this is what we normally do, but I want you to research it. Why is it so hard to go to our brother when we're offended by them or they offend us? Because there's instructions for both. If you know your brother's offended you, you need to go to your brother. I mean, if you know you offended your brother, that's what I mean. If you know you offended your brother, you need to go to them. If your brother has offended you, then they need to come to you. So forth, both ways. Both ways. Why? Why is that so hard to do? And why don't we do it? It's right here. We're told to do it. You need to look it up, and you need to study it yourself. Because I want you to own this sermon, not just me tell you what it says. We'll come out and tell you next time I cover the subject. We'll cover it in more detail. But why is it we have clearly been instructed what to do, and we don't do it? The answer may surprise you, but... In this case, I'm going to assume that you truly have been offended. You were the wronged party. And still, you shouldn't be offended, according to the scripture. I won't ask you to raise your hands, because in case you do, then you'll offend me. Is anybody here past being offended? I didn't think so. So we're all here. That's why we need this. This is why we need this. Can somebody approach you and say, can I talk to you about something? And you, or will you get defensive? Or you will listen to them and say, well, you know what? You may be right about that. I hadn't really thought about it in that way. Okay. Why is it so hard to go to your brother? And I'll talk about that later, but I'm not going to tell you now. I want you to study it. I want you to look into it. And I'm not just going to stand here and tell you what the words are and where the scriptures are. You need to look it up yourself. So, let's now go to Hebrews. We'll start in Hebrews 1. I'm sorry, we'll start in Hebrews 12, verse 1. Hebrews 12, verse 1. And as you turn there, now that I found my note on Psalms 119... 165. See that transition, how smooth that was? I hope it didn't offend you. Here's how, if you want to, and this is sort of a transliteration, if you will, of Psalms 119, verse 165. Abundant peace of mind and body have those who have beloved affection for the Torah, Ten Commandments. And there is nothing in existence, nothing that will entice them to an idol. That's in the literal, more literal translation. Idol? Hint, that's part of the problem why it's so hard for us to go to somebody who's offended us, or vice versa. Something about idols? You look it up. That's something we all need to do. We need to study these things. It's just like Mr. McDonald said, we need to stop and consider where we're at in the world now and what's happening. And I guarantee you, as we've said this before in other sermons, that Satan's goal now is to attack the church and come after it viciously. And you might as well deal with that. That's just the way it is. Just yesterday, those who are upset that the Supreme Court said that in Texas, you would be arrested if you're a doctor who did an abortion on a fetus that already had a heartbeat. And if I remember right, that's after about 50 days after conception. So it essentially kills Roe v. Wade. Okay? And this one guy's on being interviewed, and he says, these right-wing Christians, they're just as, they're the Taliban of America. So are we now going to be listed as the Taliban in that way? So there's such a vicious attack on any form of religion. On any form of religion. And yet we're told, we need to be careful as we go into this age to have that kind of abundant peace. That kind of abundant peace, no matter what we face. Now let me read to you Hebrews 12. Hebrews 12, verse 1. I could feel for Mr. Martin, I forgot your name. What's his face? Lisa would say, just read the announcements because you mess them up so bad when you add stuff. I just don't understand that. The Christmas party is at 3 o'clock this afternoon. Did I say that? No. You just goof up and you just, anyway. And you think you're reading it word for word. So, anyway. Hebrews 12 and verse 1. And this will be from the Amplified Version. Of the scripture. Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a cloud of witness, let me ask you, who's that? What is he talking about? I really would like to solicit you to comment. What is he talking about? See, we read these things, and I think you know the answer. You're just, I'm not going to say anything. And if you do miss the answer, the floor is going to open up, and you're going to have a smell, a sulfur smell and fire. Okay. Therefore, since we're surrounded by such a great cloud of witness, what's the great cloud of witness? Remember context. If this is chapter 12, the first verse.
Is it the angels watching us?
No. I mean, it could include that. Context. People of faith in chapter 11. We have their example from people like, you know, Abel and so forth, and then many unnamed because we don't have the names. You have this great example of people, and this is that cloud of witness. He's using a phrase to remind us of the time of the Exodus. There's a cloud by day and fire by night. We have this cloud of witness. Therefore, since we are surrounded by those wonderful examples of faith in chapter 11, stripping off every unnecessary weight and sin, which so easily and cleverly entangles us, let us run. So the metaphor here is a race. Let us run with endurance and active persistence, as it says in the Amplified Version, the race that is set before us. So the whole idea here is you're going to be running a race. And if you're going to be running a race, do you want to have sacks of sand tied around your leg? Like when you're out to exercise, you want to lose weight or whatever it is you want to do. And so you put on that extra, and you got those sacks of sand on your legs. That doesn't work on a track field. And here in the Greek, it also has this idea where it says that stripping off every unnecessary weight and sin, which so easily and cleverly ensnares us, the idea is there's a professional runner right next to you. Okay? And that professional runner, every time you get started, he trips you. Who could that professional runner be? The professional sinner. It so easily besets us. So he's saying here, when you look into the Greek of it, in the metaphor of a race. So here you are, you're just getting started. Maybe they trip you at the starting block. Maybe you get two jumps out ahead, and they bump you. And the judges don't see it. But it's just that kind of thing where every time you're about to get started, this guy comes along and does something to stop you. And he's an expert at it. So he says, here in this other amplified version with the classic version. There's notes in there. There was a classic version. So I'll read what it says here, and where it amplifies a little bit, and maybe it'll help you to see it. Therefore, then, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witness who have borne testimony of the truth, Hebrews 11, let us strip off and throw aside every encumbrance, those unnecessary weights, and that sin, so sin is a weight, which so readily, deftly, and cleverly clings to and entangles us, and let us run with patient endurance, steadily and active persistence, the appointed course, the race which is set before us. So we're here to do that. That's what we're to do with this race. New Living Translation puts it this way: therefore, since we are surrounded by such a crowd of witnesses to the life and faith, let us strip off every weight that slows us down, especially the sin that so easily trips us up. So I think you see that whole point there, that they're being tripped up. Now let's go to verse 2. I don't have a lot of verses because I want to spend time in the allotted time I have, which is what? Okay. Verse 2. Looking away from what will distract us, this is the implied part. So looking away from all that will distract to Jesus, who is the leader and source of our faith, giving the first incentive for our belief, and also is the finisher, bringing us to maturity and perfection. That's the amplified. They're sort of adding paraphrase. For he is the joy of obtaining the prize that was set before him, endured the cross, despising and ignoring the shame, and is now seated at the right hand of God. So we're familiar with that. So here we see him again as the source of our faith. The source of our faith, and the one who we to look to. What has this got to do with being offended? New Living Translation again, this verse. We do this by keeping our eyes on Jesus, the champion, and who initiates and perfects our faith. Because of the joy awaiting him, he endured the cross, disregarding the shame. Now he is seated at the place of honor beside God's throne. He was willing to go through whatever it took to offer us this opportunity for salvation. And he was willing to endure all of that. He was willing to endure every bit of that for us. Now, he was a man acquainted with sorrow, as we know, and yet he never sinned. We, of course, are sinners. And since we are, what business, I guess we could say what right, but I don't like to play that term, but what right do we have to get upset when somebody offends us? I mean, I do. Why? Who do we think we are to get upset? Now, Hebrews 2, I keep saying that. Hebrews 12, verse 3 now. Just think of him who endured from sinners such grievous opposition and bitter hostility himself. This is from the Amplified Bible with notes. Again, there's all kinds of different types. Okay, let's read that again. Just think of him who endured from sinners such grievous opposition and bitter hostility against himself. Reckon up and consider it all in comparison with your trials. put it in perspective. So that you may not grow weary or exhausted, losing heart and relaxing and fainting in your minds. You have not yet struggled and fought agonizingly against sin. Haven't we tried hard to overcome our own sins? Yeah, but that's not what he's talking about here. And Mr. McDonald addressed it a little bit here as well. Nor have you resisted and withstood the point of pouring out your own blood. Martyrdom, that's coming. But why does God allow that to happen? It could happen to strong Christians. It could happen to weak Christians. It depends on what God's witness is for them, what he wants them to do. And have you completely forgotten? This is to the Hebrews now. We've been doing a little Bible study in the book of Hebrews, but just real quickly, the book, the Hebrews is addressing the Hebrews. That's deep thought. Addressing the Hebrews who were returning to Judaism. Okay, they get becoming enamored with Judaism and tired of being persecuted by their own community and by everybody else. And Jesus didn't come back when he's supposed to come back, and they're just tired of it all. So, and he's giving them a warning, and he says, "And have you completely forgotten?" Verse 5, the divine word of appeal and encouragement in which you were reasoned and have addressed as sons. See, again, in which you are reasoned and addressed as sons. Don't you forget where God talked to us as his sons? Where he said, "My son, do not think lightly or scorn to submit to the correction and discipline of the Lord." The modern church in America or the Western world, to be corrected and to be spanked? How does that happen? "Nor lose courage and give up and faint when you are reproved and corrected by him." Well, how does he reprove and correct us? "For the Lord corrects and disciplines." Correction. Your child does something wrong. Your son or your daughter does something wrong. You say, "You're not supposed to do that. We told you not to do that." And now the discipline is, and here's why. Most of them think discipline just spanking automatically. There's a time for that. But the discipline is the instruction why you were told not to do that. So there's instruction in the sermons, and then there's discipline for us. So that's what we do in every message. Now this is just, again, I don't know if I should say it. Well, I will. I live dangerously, I'm retired, what do I care? you know, you have the watchman on the tower, "Cry out, spare not, tell my people their sins, and unless, you know, if you don't tell them, then their blood is on your hands, and if you do tell them, then their blood is on their head." Did I get that right? Okay. That is somewhat the role of a pastor, is it not? Every week, "Cry out, spare not, tell my people their sins." If they listen, then, or if they don't listen, the blood is on their head. If they do listen, then you see. Now, I don't mean that it's exactly what it means, but I think by principle it is there. Every week that we get instructed, and do we listen? And do we say, "Take it personally"? So I want you to take this personally. I'm trying to take it personally too. So when does this correction, reproof and correction from him as a son and his daughter should receive correction? Verse 6, "For the Lord corrects and disciplines everyone whom he loves and punishes, even scourges," spanks them pretty hard. Now, I'm not saying beat kids, you know that. "Every son whom he accepts and welcomes his heart and cherishes him." There's a time when God has to severely correct individuals and churches. You look through Revelation, they have to be severely corrected so that they will be in the kingdom. Opposite child-rearing principles of today. So all of us, we have not yet resisted to blood. "Well, when it comes, I'm ready, buddy." Okay, Peter. Don't say that. Every day should be, if that time comes for me, I pray, God, I won't deny him. I want to do what's right. I want to pray. I'm looking forward to that tribulation. Get your head examined. "You must submit," verse 7, "and endure correction for discipline." This isn't talking just to the first century church. It is. And how many of them were eaten by lions? How many of them were killed because they kept the Sabbath? These were strong Christians. Others went into a discipline to wake them up. So it isn't just those who are persecuted are the weak Christians. No, many strong Christians are tested as a good example to the weaker ones. God is dealing with you as sons. So don't think he's not going to deal with you as a son or a daughter. For what son is there whom a father does not thus train and correct and discipline? Now, if you are exempt from correction, yeah, you know, I've been in church a long time. I got this thing pretty well lined out. And I really don't think that's not for me. It's for all these other dummies in the congregation. I'm being over explicit trying to make the point. Don't think that. Otherwise, is Mr. What is your name, Matthew? McDonald. I've only known him 20 years. You know, I don't know you. I don't. That's a scary thing. As I've said in another sermon, not only when God says, I don't know you, it also saying, you never knew God. Well, I went to church all those years, so what? See? Okay, they hear me. They're coming. Now, if you're exempt from correction, verse 8, and left without discipline in all of God's children share, then you are, it says in the King James, a bastard, or in the more polite word, illegitimate offspring and not true sons. Moreover, we have earthly fathers who discipline us, and we yielded to them and respected them for training us, as it says here in the Amplified Version. Shall we not much more cheerfully submit to the Father of spirits and so live? Do you expect correction? I don't like correction. I don't enjoy trials or corrections. Again, you can raise your hand if you want. How many of you get up in the morning and say, I sure hope I get smacked with a bad trial today? In fact, the worse the better, because I can show everybody how strong. No, we don't do that. For our earthly fathers disciplined us for a short period of time and chastised us as seemed proper and good to them, but he disciplines us for our certain good, that we may become sharers of his own holiness. For the time being, no discipline brings joy, and it seems grievous and painful, but afterwards it yields the peaceable fruits of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. You have to be willing and submissive to it, willing to be trained by it. Sometimes various and sundry trials may come into our lives, and it's a form of God correcting us, and other times it's just life happening and God testing us to see what happens. Verse 12, so then brace up and reinvigorate and set right your slackened and weakened and drooping hands, and your strengthen your feeble and flaccid and tottering knees. And he's quoting Isaiah 35:3. And cut through all the firm and pain, and cut through all, I'm going to do this yet, and cut through and make firm and plain and smooth straight paths for your feet, i.e., like the John the Baptist says, this means repent. So the message is, when this happens in our lives, it's because God's wanting to bring us to repentance. And he wants us to grow deeper. Say, what has this got to do with being offended? Let's go on. So that the lame, we're last part of verse 13, and the halting, the limbs, like, you know, when may not be put out of joint. Have you ever had a bad limp, like me or somebody else? And what happens if you limp long enough on it, you mess up other joints. Like my wife, she had her ankle replaced, I don't know, 10, 11 years ago. And the doctor said, if you don't have this done, in fact, Mr. McDonald sold the doctor the saw that cut her ankle. They replaced her ankle. That's another story, because he used to sell that equipment. But anyway, so they had to cut her ankle out and then replace it. And he says, we need to do this now because your limping is messing up your other knee. You're displacing your weight and limping all the time. So he says, let's stop that, the halting limbs. The last part of verse 13, may not be put out of joint, but rather may be cured. Strive to live in peace with everyone and pursue that consecration and holiness without which no one will see the Lord. Exercise foresight and be on the watch and look out for one another. In a big church, whether it's, you know, we're in a big, we have a lot of people in this congregation and in the Dallas congregation as well, but we're pretty close together compared to like out in West Texas, where you had 45, 50 people, but spread out from Roswell, New Mexico, to south of Odessa, to north of Amarillo, well, to Oklahoma. So not a lot of people, but really, really spread out. And so it's easy to just sort of get disconnected, or in a big church, it's easy to get disconnected, where you just know your little few friends, and that's who you talk to each Sabbath. But he says, no, exercise foresight and be on the watch to look after one another, and see that no one falls back from this and fails to secure God's grace, his unmerited favor and spiritual blessing, and in order that no root of resentment or bitterness, rancor, hatred, shoots forth and causes trouble and bitter torment, and many become contaminated and defiled by it. This is what all this has to do with what we're talking about. And God says the church will make herself ready. This is going to have to be one of the major areas where we really can come at peace with each other. Be at peace with each other. Disagree with each other, but still be at peace. No two people agree on everything. My wife doesn't agree with me on everything. She's not here, is she? No. Oh, there she is. My wife doesn't agree with me on everything, but she can't help it when she's wrong. So that's an old joke that Matthew's probably sick of hearing. All right. Here's a New Living Translation of verse 15. Look after each other so that none of you fails to receive the grace of God. Watch out that no poisonous root of bitterness grow up and trouble you, corrupting many. It's like a cancer. It spreads through a group. It spreads through a family. It spreads through a congregation. So that whole, you need go over and read that material that I've just, those verses that I've told you, and apply it to you. And ask yourself a lot of questions there. Let's go now to Philippians 4. Philippians 4. I'm going to have to wrap it up here pretty quick. Yeah. Philippians, the 4th chapter. Is that something I'm supposed to wear? Or is that supposed to be on here? What did I do? Our sound man in Lubbock said, just leave it alone. Don't touch it. Okay. Okay, Philippians 4. Therefore, in the Hebrew, in the Greek, it's more properly translated, so that. It's a sort of a connecting thought, a connecting phrase to the thoughts that came before it. So that, or therefore, my brethren, beloved and longed for, my joy and my crown. See how he feels for them? Stand fast in the Lord, beloved. I exhort Euodia and Syntyche, Susie and Sally, to be of the same mind in the Lord. What am I reading this to you for? These two women are at odds with something. They're disagreeing about something, and it's affecting the whole church. Now, let me read to you from some of the other modern translations here. Well, I'll get to that in just a minute. I ask that you, I ask, verse 4, my true yoke fellow, to assist these women who labored with me in the gospel, and in Clement, and the rest of my fellow workers whose names are in the book of life. He's saying, I love you guys. I want all of you to work together here. There's these two women who are in great disagreement. Now, you think about, how would you like what's your name again? Mr. What's his face? Martin. To stand up and say, well, Mrs. So-and-so and Mrs. So-and-so are at odds with each other. Will you pray for them? Lawyers would be coming out of the wall. But in the first century, this is what this was. Philippians 1, verse 1. Paul and Timothy, servants of Jesus Christ, to all the saints. Aye, aye, aye. He's going to tell the whole church about these two women at each other's throats. So what it was, we don't know. You can speculate that the cows come home. That's not important. But he says this is a serious problem. Now it says here in the New Living Translation, I appeal to Judea and Syntyche, please, because you belong to the Lord, settle your disagreement. Settle your disagreement. Amplified Version says, I urge these two ladies to agree and work in harmony in the Lord. Because you see, they all worked with me in those early years. All of you are my dearly beloved friends in Christ. This church has served me many times, even twice when he's in Thessalonica, and they didn't lift a hand to help him. Although they were scholars, yeah, remember? These were more noble than Thessalonica, blah, 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 blah. But when he was in Thessalonica, there was no help financially for him, from them. But from these people, it were. But now something has happened, and it's affecting the whole church. These two ladies, and it's not just limited to ladies, I think we all know that. But these two ladies were important in what they were doing, and they got at each other's throats over something. And now he's saying, here's how you begin to resolve that. Verse 4, rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I say rejoice. They got their trial, they got their disagreement first in order of events instead of rejoicing in the Lord. Let your moderation be known to all men. The Lord is near. Do not be anxious about anything. So they had to have been anxious about something. But pray with supplication. So you prayer and then you get very specific prayer. With thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God in everything. And the peace, there's that word again, the shalom of God, the peace of mind and body, which surpasses all understanding, it's just from a human perspective, shall guard your heart. It's a matter of guarding your heart and thoughts in Christ Jesus. So you leave things in God's hands. Don't be anxious about anything. And I'm not asking much, huh? God doesn't ask much of us. Quit trying to fix the problem. Don't be anxious about anything. And guess what? That shalom, same word there of peace, that peace of mind, body, and spirit, which surpasses all understanding, verse 7, shall guard your hearts and minds. From what? Bitterness, resentment, hostility. Because once you start seeing things from an angry point of view, everything gets slanted by that. Finally, brethren, whatever things are true, whatever things are honorable, whatever things are just, not just if they're honorable, not just if they're true, but he says, these are things you should be thinking about. Anything that's pure, things that are lovely, things that are of good report, if there be any virtue, if there be any praise, think on these things, not what your problem is. And you'll get that peace of mind because you truly left it at God's feet. Whatever it is. Whatever you've learned and received and heard and seen in me, you have also, in me, you do also, and God, the God of peace, of shalom, shall be with you. Do we have peace? Are we at peace or are we constantly upset about something? But I rejoice greatly in the Lord that at last your care for me has been revived. Although you were already thinking about me, but you lacked the opportunity to provide. Again, they provided him assistance. What was the problem between the two ladies? Doesn't matter. I'm not saying this in respect to destitute, that I was destitute, for I've learned that in whatever circumstance I am content. So he's learned, what a lesson to learn, to be content. I've experienced being brought low, and I've experienced abounding. In everything and in all things, I have been taught both to be full and to hunger, both to abound and to be without. I can do all things through Christ who empowers me. It is Christ who empowers us to learn these lessons about not being offended, and learning those important lessons, and cutting off that cycle of destruction that Satan just loves to have and work on us with. We'll talk about more details on that as I wrap up, but I want you to think about the details we'll talk about next time is why it's so hard, and a lot of these other things. How do we deal with these kinds of things in a more specific way? But you did well to communicate with me in my distress, verse 15, for you Philippians also know that in the beginning of the gospel, when I came from Macedonia, that not one church communicated with me in regard to giving and receiving except you alone. So he was hungry, he was dealing without, he was preaching, he had to work in another job to just try to make ends meet, and only the Philippians came up. He also gave them pretty strong correction, but he was also very encouraging to them. And when I was at Thessalonica, you sent to supply my need both once and twice. I do not say this because I'm seeking a gift, but because I am first seeking that you that may abound to your credit. But I have all things and abound. So the whole point here is that he has learned these lessons. The whole point, what I'm trying to say here, is within the church in the first century, with the same problems we have today, all of us, me included, have to learn why, when we're offended, is it so hard to say something to someone else? Why? Why is it hard to hear it? Think about idle. And I'll leave you with that thought.